You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michaela Morgan. On today's show, we're looking at dependence, or independence, and the strange ways they're all mixed up. We don't get given our independence one day with a haircut or along with the lease of our first rental house. It happens over time, and we fall in and out of it in complicated ways. And that's what this episode of All the Best is about. The fine line between being independent and being dependent on someone else. Between being selfish and being selfless. And how invested our parents are in our independence, but also how compromised they are in wanting us to be their kids forever. Or how and where to get a haircut, and whether you can blame it on someone else. This is Patrick Lenton.
I used to have all this hair, back when I didn't like looking at the future. Back when everything was super new and fresh like cold wind on bleeding acne. I liked to wash my hair and condition it so it'd be soft and sleek, and I'd spend the day patting it and digging my fingers in and just kinda humming happily to myself. I didn't brush my hair so it looked like maybe I had curls. A hairdresser once told me I had fine hair, which for many years made me believe I'd go bald in my mid-20s, like my dad, or my uncles, or my cousins. But then we went to a wedding, and all the men in my family booed me during a family photo, because amongst all the sleek, bald heads, there was me. A weird puff of blonde hair that's forgotten how to be blonde. A big mass of something nondescript like light brown or tan. If I were the best friend of the protagonist in a YA dystopian novel, my hair would be described as mousy. But it would be okay because I'd be really smart and supportive. But in real life, I am not very smart or supportive, which is why I'm glad the world is not a YA dystopian novel. But my hair is mousy. I did three things when I escaped high school and went to university. I bought some Doc Marten boots, mostly because of 90s music videos. I went to an op shop and bought a tiny woman's t-shirt which said Kansas on it, which really defined my bird-like collarbones and empty stomach cavity. And I grew my hair as long as I could into a big, tangled mess. I was studying writing, and people stood in front of me and said things like, "Yes, you'll be very good at sentence construction, but be aware that this will end in 3 years and you'll have no job. The world does not need you. Be careful, you tiny fools. Beware." But every day I woke up, tangled in the soft chaos of my hair and the smooth mess of my life, and I let it all grow, not really knowing why. My mother started giving me sidelong looks, started making suggestions before family birthdays that maybe I should get a trim. She knew that she was no longer the person whose job it was to keep my hair untangled and in order, but that didn't stop her from wanting me to do it. I woke up one morning and a hair from my fringe had gotten stuck under my eyelid. When I vaguely pulled it, I felt a tugging sensation behind my eyeball and realized in my sleep the hair had swum through the water in my eye, creeping towards the brain. Things were no longer comfortable and smooth inside my hair. I found it hard to see when I drove the family car. I found peanut butter left over from breakfast on my forehead one night. But like so many things in that fresh, raw time, I had no idea how to begin untangling problems, where the start point was. And then one day at university, I found a campus hairdresser near the bar. Aha, I thought. They cut hair. They cut hair for small money. My jobs at that point were creating mazes for children for $40 a week. And once I took my clothes off for a life drawing class where all the women complained there wasn't enough of me to draw. That night, after my cheap haircut, I bought a bottle of cheap bourbon and I invited myself around to a big share house full of friends. I sat on their floor, drinking from the bottle, while everyone looked at my hair and laughed a lot because I had the pert bob of a woman who was making a sea change in her early 50s. Because I had the straight bangs and triangular flange of Adam before he turned into He-Man. After this, I waited even longer to cut my hair again, not wanting to spend another month looking like an ancient Roman lesbian. People in my degree were dropping like flies, moving into commerce degrees or advertising or having heart attacks, and my mum's friends kept asking if I was going to intern at a newspaper, not really getting that we spent our days sitting around on the grass with our stoned lecturer talking about Bulgakov. I was getting anxious and wondered what would happen in a year when I had to leave this delightful mess and be a real person. Where would me and my hair go? I started looking into hairdressers' windows when I walked past, trying to decide if I could sit down with them and say, "I don't know what to do. What would you suggest?" And then one night, after weeks of ignoring my hair by drinking cheap jugs of new and stealing cheese from poetry readings, I woke up at 2 a.m, standing in my bathroom with the light off, facing a dark mirror, naked, except for unlaced Doc Martens on my feet. I groggily switched the light on and discovered my Swiss Army knife in one hand and my entire crudely hacked off fringe in the other. Sleepwalking was not an uncommon thing for me, but somnolent barber work was. I went back to bed. In the morning, I discovered that after a shower, I looked exactly like Riff Raff from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I called up my friend Anna and asked her what to do. She laughed at me. I called up my friend Angela and asked her what to do, and she laughed at me. I wandered into the suburbs and walked into the first hairdresser I could find. "Geez, love, what happened here?" asked a friendly-looking woman with very hard-looking hair. "I let my grandma cut my hair," I riffed, suddenly aware of the dangers of describing my nocturnal knife habits. "It wasn't a good idea, because she's blind. Completely blind. Like everything in my life now, I take calm pleasure when things are neat and controllable. When I go to my barber each month and get things clipped and smoothed and trimmed, I like to remember how easy it would be for it all to go to shit again.
That was Patrick Lenton, with a story first published in Scum magazine. You can find them online at scum-mag.com. We usually associate independence with being a grown-up, with having a job, our own house maybe, the ability to pick what you have for dinner. In the next story, from producer Fiona Pepper, we hear from a man who gave up all that for a different type of freedom that's actually very structured, but it's complicated by the people he left behind.
My parents are relaxed Buddhists who occasionally have monks come and stay at their house in Western Australia. I met one of the monks, Ikakata, in his orange robes and with his shaved head. Other than the way he dressed, there wasn't really anything that gave him away as being a monk. He was a 70-year-old American man who often referred to his family. He'd been married twice, he had 3 children, and he'd run all sorts of businesses. But then he told me his 60th birthday present to himself was to join a monastery and to become a monk. Never having even studied or practiced Buddhism before then. His decision fascinated me, and I also wondered how his family took the news.
I'm not quite your average monk. I still have a foot in both camps, quite honestly. What you have to do as a monk is relinquish. You got to let go. So first thing you did let go of is those first few things like money and sex and music and keys and news and all that stuff that people do, TV, theoretically computers. But the final thing that you have to let go of is your idea of who you are. So, that's the hardest thing, letting go of your definition of yourself. Because I've been a materialist all my life until I became a monk. And it's not quite what the Buddha had in mind for his monks to be of that leaning. And I still haven't. And I have this thing about I kind of like being loved. And I mean, but the trouble is that you can't rely on that. You got to love the person and not the fact that they love you. So the reason I began was largely curiosity. And it seemed like a good place to go after leaving the woman that I'd been with. And because I didn't want to take up with another woman, I thought I'd sort of done enough of that. My passport name is Terence Milligan. My legitimate Pali or monk's name is Ikagata.
This is Ikagata's daughter, Lorian Milligan. She's 40 and lives in Canberra.
Went from Terry Milligan to Venerable Ikagata. And my mum said, "Egita?" And henceforth, Venerable Air Guitar it is.
I was interested to hear how Lorian felt about her dad's decision.
I have vague recollections of it being more along the lines of, oh, I'm going to live in a monastery for a while. It'll be near Perth. And, yeah, I think I've made several cracks about it not being personal. You know, I'm coming back to the country and you're changing seaboards. But he assured me that wasn't the case. Dad's always been the sort of man who gets a bee in his bonnet about something and sort of takes it as far as he can. Sort of the exploration will always go to a logical conclusion. And when I mentioned it to Mum, she sort of went, well, that's a hell of a way to hide male patent baldness.
Nikakata and his wife had been running a coffee shop in Braidwood, a small town in southern New South Wales, when he decided to join the monastery. I wondered how his wife took the news.
Hated it. It was unforgivable. Actually, the second wife and I hadn't had any children, though. That's the thing. She had children from a previous husband. But no, I've never been forgiven because she'd done nothing wrong, and neither did Elizabeth, the first wife. I mean, but some guys are just made for partnerships, and I'm not. If you go to a place where that everybody thinks is heaven on earth, which they all do, and it is, but if somebody leaves, that means somebody doesn't think the same way and they don't think it's heaven on earth. So how could you possibly leave Braidwood and leave Carol, who's the most popular woman in town?
Lorien moved back from the UK when she was 25, just after her dad had made the decision to become a monk. She decided to attend his ordination.
I was just meeting the lads at the monastery and I kept lunging towards people, trying to shake their hands and like, woman touchies or something like that. Sort of pop jumping backwards and putting their hands together. And it's like, oh, sorry. And then Dad's like tittering away in the corner and said to me afterwards, of course, it's like, they're not allowed to touch you. So, they're not touching me, I'm touching them. But a lot of people were quite low. Not like short, but people were down on bowing and on their knees. And I was just like, not sure I'm down with that, particularly personally. It's like I couldn't show my respects without going to that degree. But I think one of the things that I found fascinating and did make me feel slightly awkward afterwards was that people were bowing to me as well. And I couldn't quite get my head around that. I was like, oh, they're awfully polite. It's like trying to shake hands again and just not quite getting there. But with the women and the men of families who were coming to participate in the big ordination do, because I was a relation of the incoming monk, there was some sort of like respect they were paying to me as well. Probably could have done without, but it was very sweet once I understood why they were doing it.
While Lorien seemed pretty comfortable with her dad being a monk, I asked how her sister felt.
I think the one issue that my sister had with it was the physical contact, well, the forbidden physical contact with females, even if they're family. You can't shake hands, you're not supposed to hug, that sort of thing. And being a very well-educated feminist, I think she found that quite an affront, frankly. Religion, for me, unfortunately, becomes a little distasteful when it runs into dogma. And I think it's the dogmatic aspects of Buddhism that my sister is quite reacts to, especially in terms of the female interactions.
I wanted to know about the rules that Ikakata had to stick to now that he was a monk.
Key rules, well, there's four. They're divided into about five sections. So there's one is killing living beings, two is theft, three is sexual intercourse, four is, I can't remember. Oh, yeah, fourth one is claiming that you are more highly spiritually attained than you are. And the reason for that rule is that monks will sometimes say they are higher in this along the on the spiritual path than they are to get more goodies from the lay people. If you break any of those four rules, you are automatically no longer a monk. So the philosophy is that a monk can't ask for anything, you can't grow anything because you can't dig in the earth, you can't pick fruit off of trees because that's seen as damaging a living item. I mean, there are arguments about that, but we can't do anything to feed ourselves. So we have to rely on what's called dana, which is the generosity of the lay people. You don't have a word for please because you're not supposed to ask for anything. You don't say thank you because when lay people give to you, they are getting merit. Okay, they're getting points.
We'd have conversations over the precepts manual, and I've got to tell you, like, there was one that I found when we were out having lunch, and it was to do with sexuality, really. And I swear to God, this is what it said. It didn't say just don't. It wasn't like you shall be celibate or blah blah. It was something to the effect of, you cannot penetrate beyond the depth of a sesame seed. And I lost it reading that, and he thought it was hilarious, and I was finding it all hilarious. There's some farmer in Thailand trying to breed some supersized hybrid sesame seed, and they'll make a million when they manage that. And there's certain things that you know somebody thought of 2,500 years ago.
I have a throwaway line that I occasionally use with people when they say, why did you become a monk? I said, I had nothing better to do. And I really think that's true. Your primary responsibility is to yourself. And if you don't get to the core of that particular thing, then you're not wasting your life, but you are not doing, that's not prime time. I mean, to me, I just think that you've got to do this thing first, then if you can do that, and then kind of graduate to doing other stuff. But I know it's not acceptable, really, in many circles, and it sounds really selfish, but I've done okay by other people, but I just haven't pursued a couple of lines of work that perhaps would be, you know, more acceptable to the community at large. It, as a matter of fact, and this is going to sound really awful, but I can't think of anybody that, if they disappeared forever, died, that I would be as troubled by as I probably should be. There are women who would say I probably have always been like that, but I think the tendency has been, yeah, it has been like that. I think I'm much better off on my own.
So while a big part of Buddhism is about living in the moment without attachment, I wanted to know how this made Lorien feel.
It's something that, from my point of view, if he carked, I wouldn't feel terrible about our last meeting and be able to cope with that separation. And I guess that might be where he's coming from as well, is that there's no big, like, blow-up we have at the airport before he goes and like, oh, I hate you! And then he'll just, that'll be your last words to your father, to get stuffed or something like that. And it's it's just not something that's terribly worried me. I think if he had become militant at all, and I think if he attempts or had attempted to sort of really push the family away, then I'd probably be quite offended. Have a few choice words for him and then let him go about his business. I hope he's not feeling an obligation to stick with it. I certainly wouldn't want him to feel any obligation to his family to stop doing what he's doing. And I wouldn't want him to be in a situation where he's obliged to stay a monk twice a year, birthday and Christmas. I think, what do you get for the monk who has nothing? And exactly that, nothing.
That story was produced by Fiona Pepper about the ways our independence is always compromised by the ways our lives are all tangled up. This next story is about a guy called Will Bailey. He just started working at his first job.
Hi, my name is William Bailey.
What are you doing tomorrow, Will?
I'm going to my work cafe, Mr. Fox.
My name's David Bailey. I'm the father of William Bailey, who's currently 19, and William has Down syndrome. I guess quite a few years ago, I'd bitten off that William was very unlikely to be able to independently do carry out activities. For example, getting from A to B. So being able to catch a train or a tram to go to a centre or to for sort of some form of significant employment.
I'm Jerry Baker. I work for Interchange Inner East at the moment, and my job is quality and development. One of the most difficult things is understanding where your child's needs sort of fit in with what's out there on offer. Because obviously you want to be realistic, but you also want to have aspirations for the young person's future and provide all the opportunities you can get. But you also don't want to put them in a situation where they feel that they're not going to be supported. So they have to have the things that make things fun. So all the things that make things fun for other young people, friends, things they enjoy.
Do you like to play any sports?
Yes.
What?
Play the basketball and hockey and the football.
Who do you go for in the football?
My team says Saint Kilda.
And who's your favourite player?
Number 12, Nick in the remote.
After finishing secondary school, children with disabilities have the option of attending a program which aims to further their education and life skills. Even though there are a plethora of programs for families to choose from, finding one that best suits the child's and family's needs is often a taxing process.
You could literally go and see 50 programs in one afternoon if you wanted to, or at least a stall, but the time had to be invested then to take half a day to go and visit a particular program, and you know, I probably personally did that 6-8 times, and William's mum did it a similar number of times at different places, talking to other parents, not just the open days but visiting other members of the staff. It's a lot of time.
It's a really a difficult thing. They apply, they go and meet the service, they make their choices, and then they liaise with both the department and the service to try and get a place. And that will depend on the service's capacity to take them. So it's very much, you know, that ongoing negotiation that people, and that is a big pressure for families.
This pressure exists due to families finding the right program for their loved ones, yet not being accepted into the services.
My school name is Maycrocky. Jimmy Chater's name is Nick, Steph, Amy, Tibo. Deborah, my friend is Nick, Derek.
Skills learnt at the program have enabled Will to gain employment at a nearby cafe.
I wipe, clean, table, and order drinks.
2 weeks ago when I went to the cafe that he has work experience at, and just to see the look of pride on his face when he would be taking food or a coffee to a table, or when Norman, the owner of the cafe, would say, William, can you go and clear table 13 and so on, and he knew what to do to pick up all the plates and knives and forks and wipe the table down and all this, all these sort of things that we've taught him to do here at home. often to under a lot of stress, that now he can go and achieve. And that has just, that was just very uplifting.
Both the positives and negatives of William and David's relationship weighs heavily on the growth of David, not only as a father, but as an individual.
There are many, many moments that I just feel inadequate, that I'm not putting in the effort to be with him all the time that he's with me, in, I guess, inspiring him or motivating him to do different things. That's what I find very much the most stressful thing. What it has done is stretched me and really forced me to grapple and deal with things that I didn't think I could. And for that, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that I'm a better person, and that I'm a lot more forgiving and understanding than what I would have otherwise been. We all are as we are, with all of our foibles and all of our strengths. William just happens to have some foibles or some weaknesses that are a lot more visible than the rest of us. So I wouldn't necessarily change those. And I just know that not just me, but many others who are close to him who've had to help him through those are far the better for it.
Doc.
Who's there?
Stone Cold.
Stone Cold who?
Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Thanks to Matthew Jane, Nadine Keegan and Azim Iskandar for that story. This episode of All the Best was produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with Sin in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all the producers who contributed to this episode: Fiona Pepper, Matthew Jane, Nadine Keegan and Azim Iskandar. Patrick Lenton's story, The Time I Cut My Hair and Blame My Grandma, was first published on Scum Mag, an online literary magazine. You can find more rants, fiction and memoir there. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. Our community coordinator is Pitt Rasmussen. Our executive producer, Jordana Caputo. And I'm Michaela Morgan. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.